you're quite back, and also we will touch on the compensation process, which we felt we needed to satisfy ourselves that we lied.
Then there's a three-page called insurance laws amendment, health demarcation, which I'll talk through, and there's another matrix, which is of all the meetings that we've held, and I'll talk through that. Chair, I've asked Jonathan, who in a way is here in two guises, because he's been in the department doing a lot of the work, but as you know, he's passed over, but he'll talk through some of the details amendments that and the response of the department and the FSB. See, I think what I'm going to do then briefly is just to go through the process of consultation and deal with, we think that there are two material issues from all the comments and all the interactions that we've had. The one relating to the demarcation between health policies and medical schemes, and binder agreements, and then there's some technical amendments which we'll talk you through the more important ones from those. Chair, I think we've had various meetings with the insurance industry and intermediary bodies prior to the bill, and as I said, including on conflicts of interest, on the binder agreements, and this table gives you gaudy list of all the meetings that have taken place in the last year and a half or so. But after the meeting last week, we also made sure that we had many meetings. So starting on Monday, we had meetings with the industry, with the Underwriters Association, with the Short-Term Insurance Association, and the Financial Intermediaries Association. That meeting was held on Monday. Thereafter, we met with the Department of Health on Monday afternoon. Thereafter, we had a meeting on Tuesday with the LOA, and then we had meetings, we've had continued interactions with the Department of Health and the Council for Medical Schemes almost every day this week. Even when there's been no meetings, there's been lots of telephone calls, email exchanges, and yesterday we had a major teleconference of Treasury, Department of Health, Financial Services Board, and the Council for Medical Schemes. So I think we are coming here saying that we've actually got a lot more agreement, and we are not aware now of any major disagreements. You never get complete consensus on such a bill, but we think certainly we've got more than just sufficient consensus on this bill. Let me say up front that we do think, just because of the pressure on our side, the pressure on Parliament, that the period of consultation has been, less time than ideally we would have wanted. But sometimes we have to just live with these pressures. And we are mindful of that. And what we in fact want to do is to, after today, the fourth document that you'll get is a detailed response to which consolidates all the inputs that we've received from the hearings, including those, I don't know if we've yet covered those that have come even after the closing date, because we've said to those people who have submitted to Parliament that we'll consider their inputs. For example, there are two inputs from, I think, Professor Diane McIntyre from UCT and the AIDS Law Project. They deal with the same issues that we've been dealing with in health, so I think we'll have dealt with their issues just through the process that we've had with health. But we've said that we'll look at those. And when we have the detailed matrix which will respond and kind of say how we're going to amend the table bill, subject to only now legal refining, certification, etc., that we would, after today, invite all those who have submitted inputs and anybody else who wants to come to a meeting at the Treasury, where we'd want to have one more workshop just to see whether anybody still has outstanding issues after having looked at our response today. And to the extent that there are any material issues that arise, we will certainly come back and inform you of those and of our response. So in a way, we, as a department, we're saying we're very open to hearing further input after people have looked at our responses today, which we really believe deal with all the issues in a way that I think is a huge step forward and an improvement on the Provision Act, which I think for us certainly the parliamentary hearings are very important because they do raise important issues that we have to take quite seriously. Chair, let me deal with the first. So I should just end by saying we are inviting those who are interested from those who have submitted inputs to a meeting at the National Treasury, 240 Vermeulen Street, at 11 o'clock next week, Tuesday. We will email them the time, and we are also saying to anybody else, if they can't attend the meeting, they are free to send us their comments in writing. Whatever we receive, Chair, we will hand over to you as well for your information for members of the committee. Chair, just let me deal with the first major issue that arose, which is the demarcation between health policies and medical schemes. Now, our friends in health, what's very nice about it is they tend to be very passionate about health. So that's, I think, for me, a very good sign, and tend to argue very robustly about their views. Of course, sitting in the Treasury, we have to say, hold on, we also have to deliver on education and other issues and contain them sometimes. But it's nice to have such vigorous discussions. And, you know, the key concern, if you look at all the inputs, is that this demarcation should not undermine the purpose and objectives of the Medical Schemes Act, which is largely around the fact that you want a kind of form of community rating. You don't want medical schemes only to attract those that are sick or need medical aid, and everybody else young and healthy kind of goes through a more risk-rated system like insurances. There's no doubt that that would make medical schemes unsustainable. And we've said to them that they should have no fear that certainly in the Treasury we strongly believe in those principles. So it's not that we are there reluctantly. I think it's a very important principle, and that's strongly supported, and it's nothing we want to do in this legislation that will in any way undermine those principles. We've also felt that, one of the major exercises we have in government is to ensure that our regulatory agencies are more effective. And we have a process which we will be coming back to you with at some point in Parliament, to kind of look at recent lessons that we've learned, be they weaknesses or be they that there are gaps in our system, how to make our regulators more effective. And of course, part of that exercise is that we've got to get the different regulators to work together, because today, typically, you could have a company that does banking, that does insurance, that does medical schemes. So you've got regulators for each of those. Is there not a need for some coordination or some work between the regulators? And I think that's quite a challenge for our regulators, that they work together and don't just try and stick to their patch and miss the big picture. So we've kind of, in line with that approach, we felt that we need to, as part of our principle, jointly agree on a demarcation that will allow health insurance policies that are regulated between the two insurance acts on one hand, and certainly with the Medical Schemes Act, that we need a kind of joint approach, and I think we have got joint agreements in the sense. And in line with those, I think the changes that we've made to the table book, firstly, is that, and the key issue, and just to perhaps focus on this piece of paper, Chair, that we've circulated, I don't know if members all have that. This represents the agreement that we've had.
Well, are you, if the one titled insurance law amendment goes health demarcation?
And I should add that, you know, this, it's been verbally indicated to us now by the Council for Medical Schemes that they support what you have on this, on these pages, as well as from the Department of Health. I'll start with the amendment of Section 72, that's point 23, so at the bottom of the first page. That is really the one big issue, and if you notice what we've done there is to basically change from saying that before the minister would have done it, issued the regulations on of a health policy or the exemptions in terms of, or after consultation with the Minister of Health, that the minister would in fact now do it in consultation with the Minister of Health. We've also allowed for a process where the Treasury will consult with the two regulators. Part of the agreement, you'll see that we've also agreed that the info on health policy products must be filed by companies with both the registrar, that each registrar will then act on any enforce or act on breaches of regulations in terms of their own act. So we don't have to have any process between the two registrars. This is what they thought we should be doing. There was one other issue that the Council for Medical Schemes had raised. They have had problems with the definition of business of a medical scheme in a recent court case, how that was being interpreted, and they wanted to bring an amendment. They were quite keen that this amendment be done via this act. We felt that it would be better done under the Medical Schemes Act, and by this morning there is even consensus on this that the Department of Health would introduce this amendment because they do have the Medical Schemes Act or an amendment to this before Parliament currently, which they've just tabled. So this now has not been dealt with in this bill by agreement. As I said, we were reluctant to just amend another act, a health act in our, but the Treasury we didn't want to proceed, and we said unless you are very militant and you come to Parliament and argue for it, we are not going to include it in our bill. We agree with the changes that you have in mind, but please do it in the Medical Schemes Act, and that's the agreement. So Chair, that's the agreement, and what you then notice in these provisions is, as I said, that Section 23 is the big amendment, and you'll see that there's a similar provision, Section 52, because you've got to change both the Long-Term Insurance Act, Section 72, and Section 70 of the Short-Term Insurance Act. And then there are some consequential changes that we have to make to the definition of health policy, which follow through. But that, in essence, I think, is a change in the definition of accident health policy. I don't know, Chair, do you want to work through these pages now, or? Do you want to do that after the presentation?
You mean the two that you're talking to?
Yes, just this page, which encapsulates all the...
I think we should deal with these ones and for all, because they deal with those...
You want to deal with it now?
Yeah, let's deal with it now.
Okay. So, perhaps let's just go through then Section 1. I don't know if Joanne wants to just go through it, because she's had to get the legal provisions in. Do you want to just talk through these two pages? I mean, I've given the broad outline, and what the intention is. I think that if she can just deal with the specific wording.
Chair, sorry, just one query. Is anybody here from Department of Health?
No. No, we don't have the Department of Homeland.
We had strongly urged them to attend. I don't know if there's someone from the Council for Medical Schemes. I don't see anybody. We had strongly urged them all to attend, but I guess by this morning they felt that they all support this, and that's why they're not here.
You know, I must also say that from our side, we had strongly urged the Portfolio Committee on Health to attend. And, we have a slightly similar situation. But we will proceed anyway, because it is our deal. But it's important. Maybe in our final meeting, I think our agent should be like a little bit stronger, so that we are comfortable that we really have the buy-in. Normally, when we deal with the bills of this nature, I agree with the thing. We would like to have both officials and also from our side to have, even if it's not the entire committee, but at least the committee serves people. It helps because, you know, some of the questions that otherwise you find outside of these walls, you know, which might indicate that there is an agreement, even though that, you know, officially we did this agreement, it helps to deal with the.
I think if I can just add to that, we have an email from the Register of Medical Schemes, which we can make available, which confirms the agreement with the wording, and we can procure a similar written undertaking from health, if that might alleviate members' concerns. If I can then just talk people through the amendment. If you look at the table bill, it's page 30, from line 38 onwards. And suggestive is stating that the Minister of Finance can make regulations. Despite the definition of a business or medical scheme identifying a client type or category of contract as a health policy, those regulations, however, may only be made in consultation with the Minister of Health, which implies her agreement, after consultation between the National Treasury, the Register of Short and Long-Term Insurance, as well as the Register of Medical Schemes. And those regulations must also have regard to the objects and purpose of the Medical Schemes Act, specifically three critical issues or principles that pertain to these type of products, which is community rating, open enrollment and cross-subsidization between medical schemes. And then those regulations will also provide for a long-term insurer to submit specific information within specific time frames to both registrars, and that information will assist the Register of Medical Schemes as well as the Register of Long and Short-Term Insurance to identify if those products fall within the scope of the regulation. Should the Register of Medical Schemes deem it not to fall within the definition, they will then take action in terms of their legislation, and the Register of Long and Short Term will take action in terms of the insurance laws. And then the regulations, which was basically just a previous requirement which we've moved down, to say that the regulations may also relate to the design and marketing of those kinds of products. And both those provisions will apply to long and short term insurance.
Okay. Is that okay with members? Because what I also discovered was that some members were struggling to get it on the bill itself. Are we on the same page? Okay, fine. Okay, cross it there.
Major material issues relates to the provisions around binder agreement. I'm going to ask Jonathan to go through it because they are, I think, quite pretty complex. And we've tried to unpack from the different inputs that were made on current practices, really separate the intermediaries from the underwriters. But let me give it to Jonathan, and perhaps it might even help them just to go through the specific amendments in a similar way, I think.
Thanks, Chair. I think in terms of general comments on the binder agreements, as Momo pointed out, we've had a number of meetings with different industry associations, and I think there's really what came out of the hearings last week and through those discussions is a recognition that there are various forms of binder arrangements. Up until now, the Act has really only dealt with underwriting managers, which are parties who have complete discretion in terms of how they bind an insurer. But what's apparent is there are also variations of binder agreements where you may have brokers or intermediaries who have a certain amount of limited binding authority on the part of insurers as well. So what we have to achieve or hope to achieve through the amendments is our provisions that cater for those possible different classes of binder arrangements. I think the second guiding principle is also the recognition that some of the discussions around binder arrangements are interrelated with some of the broader policy reform discussions that are going on, in particular discussions around the intermediary relationship and clarifying in what capacity intermediaries are operating, whether they're acting as an agent for the client in giving advice, or in cases where brokers are being paid commission by insurers, are they really acting as a sales agent of the insurance company? So it's quite hard to talk about certain principles in this regard until in isolation from that discussion. But having said that, I think there was agreement amongst all parties that the majority of the provisions dealing with binder arrangements are accepted as applying to all classes of binder, and those would be the provisions dealing with that any binder arrangement should be in terms of a written agreement, and what should be included in that written agreement, and the fact that even though there's a binder arrangement, the ultimate liability still lies with the insurance company. As was highlighted by the hearings, the issues where there wasn't consensus or where there were concerns related to really two aspects. The first was the type of remuneration that a binder party could receive for performing a for that binder arrangement. In particular, whether people with a binder arrangement can share in the profits from the underwriting, so those profit sharing arrangements. The second one was who would a party with a binder authority be permitted to deal with, because as we heard, the underwriting managers, which is the parties with complete discretion of binding authority, are in the existing Act prohibited from, in effect, dealing directly with the public. They can only be referred business either by an insurance company or an intermediary. Now, and that was something that we included in the original proposed amendment, but it was brought to our attention that that obviously poses a problem for brokers with binding authority, these intermediaries or brokers who have limited binding authority, because by their nature they do deal directly with the public. So those were the two issues. What we're reporting back on is that certainly in terms of the scope of binder arrangements, I think there's always been broad consensus on that. What we have done though is try to clarify in a sense the definition of binder arrangement, which is the first subsection, if you like. And what we've tried to clarify is that we're only really talking about the binder arrangement where that third party has the ability to either create a liability for the insurer, in other words, enter into a policy on behalf of the insurer, or where that third party has an ability to vary the liability of an insurer, either by varying the policy or by having discretion to settle the claim and therefore determining the insurer's liability. So we're trying to clarify that we're not talking about general outsourcing arrangements by insurers. We're only talking about where there's an agency relationship that either creates or varies a liability for the insurer. And then, as I said, we've retained the provisions dealing with what should be included in the written agreement, retention of the concept that the insurer has ultimate liability, and that the insurer also has ownership of that client information, because the binder is acting as an agent or an extension of the insurer. Now, the two more difficult issues that I discussed, in other words, the remuneration and profit sharing arrangements, and the who the binder party can deal with. I think we, in discussions with industry, I think it was agreed among all parties that what's become evident is that there are various hybrids of these kind of arrangements, and I don't think anyone, possibly not even the industry, has gone through a process of completely identifying all the varieties of binder authorities that currently exist. So what we are proposing, and which I think was initially found some support with industry is the concept of having some enabling provisions that we'll deal with some of these issues through regulations, in particular regulations that allow for the identification of different classes of binder arrangements. What type of remuneration would be appropriate for the different classes, and if you like, the structure of the binder arrangement, would the different classes be able to deal directly with the public, or would they have to be referred the business? I think the agreed principle there was to allow a process to, whilst we are confident that we could, that we've identified certain principles, we also want to allow the possibility of considering whether we have covered all the possible permutations. So it really is to some extent it's a sort of technical implementation issue of making sure that the provisions are appropriately targeted at different types of binder arrangements, but we'd like to do that we'd like to make sure that we've crossed all the T's, dotted the I's, and that we've covered things, and therefore, you know, the proposal is to have a regulatory process to allow for a period of further consultation, and because it's actually quite detailed technical issues which may not be appropriate for legislation in any case. Now we did subsequently receive some concerns from industry around the issue that technically the registrar or the minister could prescribe regulations, and there is no formal requirement for the minister to gazette regulations after consultation or after public comment. I mean, obviously, we did make the point that it is the practice of the Treasury and the Minister of Finance to always do that anyway, but they are obviously correct that there is no formal requirement. So to address those concerns, we are also proposing explicit provisions in the Act that for those regulations that there be a formal process of consultation and comment. To give some comfort to industry and other interested stakeholders that there will be a proper process of consultation around those regulations. I think the other thing to mention is for the committee to consider. There is also, of course, the option of saying that such regulations should also be tabled in Parliament for this committee's consideration, and if the committee supports that, we would welcome that as well as a means of formalising the consultation. So that's the introduction, I think. Let me just find the matrix, the thicker document.
Okay. So has it been circulated to members? The matrix with the technical amendments and the responses in the matrix. Okay.
Let me just find the right page here. Here we go. It is on page 44. Page 44 is dealing with the Short-Term Insurance Act, but the same principles would apply to the Long-Term Insurance Act, just with the omission of Lloyd's underwriters, because that's just a short-term industry. So what we've done, as I said in the first section, we just changed some of the wording to make sure that we're only referring to functions that either create or vary liability for the insurer. For instance, in 1E, it used to say settle or pay claims. Now, if there is a party who simply pays claims without deciding on how much that payment should be, then that's not really a binder arrangement. That's simply an administrative outsourcing arrangement. So therefore, that's been removed. And obviously, we'd welcome comment on whether we've achieved what we've set out to achieve there. The provisions in 2, as I say, they were we didn't really receive much comment on that, and those were generally supported. I think we've got a problem in my version. The matrix doesn't go beyond; it cuts out. So we'll have to. Sorry, Chair.
Page 44.
Yeah, on page 44, it starts with this section 2, talking about what a written agreement must include. It follows on the next page, and then on the next, on the following page as well, and goes up to 2G. Unfortunately, there are sections 3, 4 and 5, and possibly 6 as well, as far as I can remember, that I don't know what, where they've got. I think they've got somehow lost in this word table. I think we overloaded the matrix. But if it's okay for us to circulate the wording immediately.
Yeah, but how soon can that happen? Because it should be done while this meeting is continuing, because I would imagine we'll be leaving out a critical, very critical area of our discussion. You want to check if you've got it in your pocket? Oh, let me speak. Page 44. Okay. That's it.
Okay. Hopefully they find it. If we can move to the technical amendments, these are really the major the technical amendments. And as we discussed in the briefing, it's really about bolstering the regulatory framework to ensure that the regulator achieves the objectives of ensuring the maintenance of financial soundness of insurance companies. And the first two points there around auditors and statutory actuaries. In many ways, the auditor and statutory actuary are the first line of defense of proper supervision of insurance companies. The auditor obviously is checking the financial aspects of the insurance company, and the statutory actuary has functions in terms of ensuring that the insurer is maintaining appropriate reserves and so on to protect the financial soundness and solvency of the insurance company. On the auditor, the main thrust of the comments received was a concern that the scope of the auditor's reporting to the registrar was being expanded, because it was being expanded beyond reporting on material contraventions that they come across to reporting on all contraventions. That's only all contraventions that they come across as part of their function as the auditor of the insurance company. We're proposing that those comments not be accepted, because certainly the view from the Treasury and the FSB is that all contraventions of the Insurance Act are material contraventions, in a sense. There should be no contraventions of the Insurance Act. And that if there are any contraventions, then the registrar should know about it. And it would seem odd for an auditor, if during the course of their functions of an audit, if they come across a contravention, that they should not be reporting of that contravention to the registrar. There was comments that that auditors should apply the materiality principle that they normally apply in reporting to the IRBA. The problem there is that that materiality concept is expressed as a rand amount, only if the contravention exceeds a certain rand amount. Now, when you're talking about statutory contraventions, it's not always the rand amount which is important. It's something a lot harder to quantify, but it goes to the compliance culture of the insurance company concerned. So, moving on to the statutory actuary, most of the comments also related to similar issues around the scope of the requirements on the statutory actuary to report any concerns that the statutory actuary comes across in the function of their duties. So if there is anything the statutory actuary finds that is threatening the financial soundness of the insurance company or may threaten the financial soundness of the insurance company, they should report. There was comments on the fact that this was broadened in the amendment to say that the statutory actuary should report on concerns that he or she comes across in terms of all sections of this act. And the comment was, well, it's not really the role of the statutory actuary to report on all contraventions or concerns. In fact, that then starts to remove the role of the statutory actuary into the realm of the compliance officer. And I think we have taken on board, and we are proposing to the committee that those comments be accepted, and that the scope of reporting the statutory actuary be limited to those aspects of the act that deal with his or her function as the statutory actuary of protecting the financial soundness of the insurance company. Then on the valuation of assets, really that was just a clarification there. There is currently a provision that enable the registrar, if they're not happy with the certain value of put on an asset in the statutory return, to question that value. I think the concern came more from the use of the word proper value, proper valuation, and there were a lot of questions about, well, what is a proper valuation? What we're clarifying is that by proper valuation, what we're really meaning is a reasonable value for statutory purposes, for the purposes of the statutory return. So that which is quite distinct from the concept of fair value in terms of accounting or financial reporting. We're saying, yes, you must use for fair value for your financial reporting, but when it comes to the statutory returns and looking at solvency issues, there may be cases where you need to put a different value for statutory purposes to what would be the fair value for financial reporting circumstances. And I suppose an example would be a valuation on an insurance company's head office. For instance, if Old Mutual had to give a value to their Pineland office, there could be a certain financial fair value in terms of financial reporting. But if you're concerned about solvency and what that implies, if the insurer was in a situation where they were facing a solvency challenge and had to have liquid assets, would they be able to sell their finance office in a short period of time? Probably not. So we need to have a much more conservative value for purposes of statutory return. So those are the types of issues that were dealt with there. And lastly, there was also some comments around the changing to the structure of the provisions dealing with when an insurer can hold derivatives. Now, it's always been the view that insurance companies should not invest in derivatives for speculative purposes. And that was in the existing act, and nothing's changed in the proposed amendments. But the comments did state that there may be cases where an insurer may need to have an open position in terms of its derivatives if it is offsetting what is an unavoidable position that it has in terms of providing, for instance, long-term annuity products. So I think it was recognized that the proposal is to restructure the section to clarify that whenever it's for, you know, part of portfolio management or investment management, you know, if they're holding those assets purely for investment purposes, they can't hold the derivatives for speculative purposes. They can only do it for hedging purposes. So they have to have the derivatives and the underlying, and expect to have the underlying assets at the end of the contract. So in other words, they can only have closed positions. The one exception that we have, so we've added a paragraph E, we said it's the only exception where it may be reasonable for an insurance company to have an open position is where they are facing what's called investment risk. And by investment risk, that term refers to where a insurance company has long-term liabilities and has certain assets to try and back those liabilities, but there may not be a perfect match between the assets and liabilities because there are limited long-term assets out there in the marketplace, so there may not be a perfect match. And if there is a movement, say, in interest rates, the change in the value of the assets may not totally compensate for the change in the value of the liability, so that difference is called the investment risk. And it may be that the only, you know, that an efficient way to try and deal with that investment risk is through an open hedge position. So we have allowed for that, but what we have said is we only allowed with the written agreement of the statutory actuary, so that statutory actuary has to sign off and say that's okay. Okay, those were the main technical amendments. Okay, I think we'll join. The other proposal is that we could possibly go through the matrix until we get to that section, or have questions.
Yeah, maybe we should quickly take questions on this presentation from members, particularly on the technical amendment, and if there are questions on any of the ones that have taken the issue of the consultation, the demarcation, the binding agreement, and the technical amendment, so then we go to. But the matrix also speaks partly to the consultation and the demarcation as well, which I don't know.
So my question is on consultation. The again, consultation industry and more also, you know, first of this meeting there might be another workshop to discuss consultation industry. But my question is that in this matrix or in this list that there's no way that they show they are consulting also the CBOs or NGOs. We've got the submissions from the 38 projects in India where they also complain that they've not been consulted. So how are they dealing with such a...
How broad is the consultation? My question is on derivatives, on the use of derivatives and seeking the approval of the statutory on the actuary before undertaking such a hedging process. I just want to establish. I'm not clear about some of these issues. The statutory actuary, does it refer to an outside actuary
or an actuary within the company. If I could just get a quick clarification on that so that I could then go for two more questions.
Before you pose your question.
Answer.
It's in this amendment. It's in the amendment. Yeah. Okay.
The statutory actuary. I'm not sure of the exact definition, but basically it can be either or. It can be larger insurance companies tend to be big enough to have their own dedicated in-house statutory actuary. And smaller ones would tend to outsource to an independent statutory actuary.
Okay, just a minute for interest's sake. If let's say it's an outside actuary, how often would they have to consult that statutory actuary before they can undertake such a hedging process? I'm not familiar with the industry. How often do you have to undertake those hedging processes? That would be the other question. Because if it's on a daily basis or a weekly basis, is that feasible if you have to deal with an outside actuary?
Dr. George?
Thank you, Chair.
On the binder agreement, my understanding is that you have an underwriter, then you have an agent, and then you have a customer. And there's an agreement between the underwriter and the agent. In the case of Lloyd's, you have names that are underneath the underwriter. So you've really got sort of pieces in this process, and then you've got gaps between the processes. Now, I know you said that you're looking at various categories between these gaps. But if you go to the end of the chain and you look at the customer, that is not visible. So, you know, I'm told I'm on risk, or I'm changing my risk, etc. But that's really between me and the agent. And then behind the scenes, there's this other agreement. Now, my understanding is that you are regulating the gap between the agent and the underwriter in certain ways that you're looking at. Now, I'm not quite sure, or maybe I just don't understand it, is exactly how you do that, and exactly then how it is obvious to the person out there. So I've got comfort knowing that here I am, there is an agreement, and it's okay. So that's the question. And then on the derivatives issue, I know you're saying it would hedge only when there is this issue of investment risk, but that's not always visible. So you're going to possibly rely on the actuary. Probably will rely on the actuary and hold them to account in some way. But how do you really know that the actuary has actually got it right? Thanks, Chair.
Thanks, Chairperson.
Thank you, Chair. Just two quick observations, and the one is also a question. I'm glad that that you know, the whole consultation issue has been addressed, and I really trust that the industry role players will also, you know, take part in this, and that we really eventually when it gets back to us that it's really an inclusive process. So you know, that's good, that's fantastic. In terms of, in the technical amendments, you refer to the valuation of assets, and you refer to a reasonable value in terms of, you know, for actuarial purposes. But shouldn't that be in the definitions as you, where you define what is a fair value? Shouldn't you at least give a directive in terms of definition what it refers to? Otherwise, at least it's open for interpretation. In the moment that it's subjective interpretation, then obviously it's wide open for conflicts. And just want your comments on that, please. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. There is some way you say that the registrar can appoint another person to do the valuation of the assets. I want to check, other than this period or those instances, can the registrar appoint an independent person to do the valuation?
Maybe it's outside this bill. I just want to find out from the FSB. Let's take this scenario. We agreed to the bill, and the statutory actually would have to give approval before they can hedge on the investment risk. How often would you get those type of reports? Because the use of derivatives can be dangerous, especially if there's no underlying asset. People can use it for speculation. How do you then be able to tell that people are sticking to the law? What are the time frames that you have to look at so that you can ensure that people are not using derivatives for speculative purposes? Because like I always say, derivatives can be wild beast of finance. You don't use them properly, then you unleash a machinery that you cannot control.
Okay. Most of the work is going to be for Jonathan. I don't know if Kathy wants to also come in. But just with regard to the consultations with CBOs and NGOs, we will be inviting them to the Tuesday meeting. In fact, I've also emailed them. So their concerns were similar to the concerns that were already expressed by the CMS submission. So, you know, in dealing with those concerns of the CMS and Department of Health, dealt, I believe, with their concerns. But we will give them an opportunity to come on Tuesday, and once we've provided them with the response that we've circulated today, to come back and see whether they still have any reservations. So the consultations will include that. It's an open consultation. All those people who have sent something, either on time or even after, and anybody else who's interested, they can either do it in writing or attend the meeting thereafter. I think all the other questions referred to are for Jonathan to answer around the book.
Thanks, Jay. I mean, if I can start with the questions, number of questions around the use of derivatives by the insurance company. Actually, a lot of good questions, because they're the same kind of questions we had to be asking ourselves. And what I'll actually do is I'll ask our actuaries in the house to respond to the specifics on, you know, what is our expectation on how often in practice would it mean that a statutory actuary would have to sign off on these kind of derivatives, how often we'd get the reports. The one thing I would like to clarify is that we're not in fact putting anything, proposing anything new in terms of the use of derivatives by the insurance companies, because currently they can enter into open-ended derivatives for the purposes of hedging their investment risk. I think we've restructured the wording to clarify it, but they can and they are currently doing so. I guess what we are adding is a requirement that they can now only do so with the written agreement of the statutory actuary. And whether the statutory actuary does the right thing or not, I guess, is one of those you know, it's always going to be that problem for you. The statutory actuary is there with a specific function, and they have that function to perform, and they have to exercise discretion on prudent management of solvency and so on. There are a lot of discussions going on, currently with in terms of another process that the FSB is engaged in with re-looking at the role of the statutory actuary and whether there are sufficient controls and comforts that they're doing their job. But I think we can't do much more than say, okay, statutory actuary, this is your function, and do it as well as you can. But as I say, the other process is also looking at whether there's sufficient checks and balances there. So perhaps I'll ask the actuaries to come in at the end to add some more details there.
Look, actually, always have it right.
Yes. on the binders, to respond to Honourable Member George's comments about how are we making sure that we are regulating that the possibility of a party in between the client and the ultimate underwriter. Now, the insurance company is underwriting the risk. Now, what we're clarifying is that if there is a party between the client or the agent or the intermediary and the ultimate underwriter, that is really done on an on an agency basis for the insurer. The insurer continues to carry the ultimate underwriting risk. They can't get away from that. Despite what we've seen in recent times about some disputes around the responsibility of certain insurance companies to stand behind liabilities that have been created. It's precisely because of the possibility of insurance companies trying to fuddle their responsibilities, their liability for that underwriting, that we are making it very explicit that the insurer retains the liability, and we're saying that if there is a party in between, then that party acts as an agent of the insurer, and they must clearly disclose at all times that they're acting as an agent of the insurer. The name of the insurance, the ultimate underwriting insurance company, must be disclosed on all policy documentation. The client information that allows the insurance company to do the proper, to check that the underwriting is done properly, belongs to the insurance company. The insurance company must have access to that information. So that's, I think it hits the nail on the head. That's exactly what we're trying to make sure, that by having a party in between, people may try to somehow fuddle that responsibility. And then there was, just lastly, there was also a question around, before I get there, the reasonable value for statutory purposes and whether it can be defined. I think that would be tricky to define, in that you possibly would create a circular reference, because what's really being said there is that a reasonable value for these actuarial or statutory purposes is at the discretion of the registrar. So it can't really be defined. It's in according to guidelines of the registrar, what would be reasonable for statutory purposes, or in the view of an independent expert, what would be a reasonable. That's why we're very happy there is a subsequent week for further comment to make sure that we've got the wording correct, or if there's a better way to capture that concept. But in a sense, it's saying there may be cases where you have to deviate from the definition of fair value because of individual or particular circumstances. And then the last question was around the possibility
from the one. What has necessitated this kind of
Okay, I think I'm going to take advantage of having the Prudential head of Prudential Regulation here as well to go into the specifics.
But you might have mentioned it in your original document, perhaps, where you were talking about the problems encountered and how
And I'll also ask Suzette Fulkerson, who's head of Prudential, to also answer the question about bringing in an independent person to do the valuation, and when and why would we want to do that?
Perhaps take your last question, and then she can deal with it. Deal with your last question, Jonathan.
Sorry, Chair, that was my last question around the when or why would you use an independent person to do the valuation?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The requirement for adjusting a value at the discretion of the registrar has always been in the Act, just been in the latter part of the Act in Schedule 3. We moved this requirement also to the one of the solvency tests, that's the spreading test, that looks at the asset composition and how it matches the liability principle. And valuation of the assets for that specific test is done on fair value basis, while the valuation of the other test, the solvency test, are done on valuation on fair value and in certain circumstances on a valuation basis we prescribe. So we just thought for that test to still have the discretion if we do feel an asset is valued not reasonable for statutory purposes, that we might re-look or determine a different value to be placed on that investment. And maybe if you will allow me, I can give you an example. An insurance company might have another insurance company as a subsidiary. For fair value purposes, they will show that subsidiary at embedded value, which is much higher than the actual solvency position of that other insurance company for our purposes. So we might say, well, knowing about the other insurance company as well and the risk they are facing and their business model, well, for statutory purposes, we would rather have you determine it according to statutory solvency position than at embedded value. And for that reason, we put the discussion in there. To answer the other question, in which case we will appoint an independent person, I think it's where you've got assets or type of assets where we don't have the expertise to value. One might be property. I mean, we're not property experts, so we might get an independent property valuator in. Or it might be where an insurance company invests in a manufacturing type of setup where we don't have the expertise to value the machinery, equipment, the stock, and so on. So in those cases, we might get an independent person to assist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The intention is definitely not for the statutory actuary to sign off every single transaction that is being made, but rather in a similar sense as they are currently looking at asset liability matching and the whole investment strategy of the insurer, that there must be a written framework within which the investment managers can work, and as soon as it gets out of that thing, there's like a written agreement of the limits and in what circumstances they can do that. So in practice, in an insurer, that consultation would take place as and when these limits are breached, or initially to set up the investment strategy regarding these derivatives. We get information on that currently already every year in the annual return. We can also ask for anything at any time, and we also ask for these things when we go on on-site visits, especially if we know the type of problem with that. And then also just to add that the statutory actuaries are appointed in their personal capacities, so they sign off their life away when they sign things, and there's also professional conduct standards from the actuarial society which they need to adhere to, and if they breach that, then they are subject to disciplinary processes.
And it may be that this amendment that we put in might lead to another actuarial professional new guidance notes that might have to be developed.
Okay. Among the things you raised was the issue of the tabling of the regulations in Parliament for the committee's consideration. I think we have a standard agreement with yourself that that should be the line. We don't wait for this engagement for us to give you that line. You must always have it whenever you come to this committee. You must know that when we come to regulations, there is a running line that this committee would like to have sight of the okay. We now proceed to the matrix.
Thank you, Chair. Right, page 2. Starting at the top, clause 1. 2 of 49, 1 down, 48 to go. definition of this act. There were comments around the inclusion of directives and notices and requests in the definition of this act. This is an issue that's been raised before in bills before this committee, and the amendment for consideration is proposing. Is really aligning the definition with what has been recommended in other bills, like the FIC amendments bill, for instance. Definition of the fair value of an asset. It was recognised that we don't always use fair value of an asset as a term, as a term with all those words in it. Sometimes we use fair value in isolation or fair value of liability, so we just refer to fair value. Fund that has already been was corrected in the. And this would apply throughout the bill. There are a number of references to the Medical Schemes Act, so instead of quoting the full reference, we're proposing to define the Medical Schemes Act fully and then only refer to the Medical Schemes Act. Definition of health policy was covered in the separate document.
Just in that Medical Schemes Act definition, when I see the amendments, you still refer to Medical Schemes Act from 1898 and some places Medical Schemes Act.
Which amendment?
You see, under the definition, they say they only call it Medical Schemes Act and just stop there and define it. But in the amendments that were given to us, Section 52 and 23, I think, you've still got 1998.
Okay.
Chair, I have to apologize. There may be, due to time pressures, we may not have caught every little. But thanks.
So you'll attend
to that.
Okay.
There was comments on the deletion of the definition of market-related policy. Just a comment noted that there was agreement, but we'd have to make sure that we're in regulations or board notices. We use that term. We would have to define it in there, and we agree with that. Definition of registrar, there was a typo in the original version, and that was subsequently corrected in the tabled version. New definition of widely held company. Again, a term that is used quite often, so we're proposing that there be a definition of widely held company inserted. We're also noting that obviously we're aware that the Companies Act is currently going through a reform process and that term widely held company may or may not be around for much longer, but whilst it is there we are cross referencing, but noting obviously we will look out for, in terms of ensuring a consequential amendment if there is, if the company's bill is promulgated. There was a query about whether we should define binding agreement. Our proposal is that the comment not be accepted because the term is only used in a heading and the content of the section really sets out the core functions of a binding agreement. Moving on to clause 2, this is again where there was a typo in the original version. Clause 3, this is deals with the issuing of directives. Much of this comment is actually addressed by the proposed change to the definition of this act. But we are proposing a couple of wording changes. Then also under in that clause there's prescription in respect of health policies and the proposed product pre-approval required by the FSC and CMS. As earlier discussed, those issues have been dealt with through the consultations. Clause 4, just a small thing there, we are proposing that we use the word conducts instead of undertakes. We agree it's a better wording. Sorry, a small thing, but clause 6, this is dealing with the appointment of the auditor. And there were really it amounts to some suggested wording changes, which we are proposing to be accepted. A cutting out problem there as well, but really it is reflecting the wording on the in under the comments. The one area that we are there's also a comment about language which we think the current wording is clear. So it's mostly around wording issues there. Then this comes on to the substantive technical issue that I discussed in the presentation about whether the reporting function of the auditor should be expanded or not. I think you can see from our response there that, you know, really the auditor's work is viewed as an extension of that of the regulator. And we're actually talking about a different materiality concept. Then the next clause deals with the statutory actuary, those are the issues we discussed about not turning the statutory actuary into a compliance officer, which we are proposing be taken into account, and we limited the reporting function of the statutory actuary to reporting on issues dealing with his or her function with respect to financial soundness. Then moving on to clause 8, this deals with the audit committee. There were some comments that were references to the earlier version of the bill that were corrected in the tabled version. In fact, most of those comments are. There was one proposal whether there should be an inclusion of specific requirements for persons appointed to an audit committee of insurance companies, but the proposal from our side is that it wouldn't be appropriate for the registrar to be prescriptive in this regard, in that it's in any case good corporate governance to appoint people with appropriate and relevant experience to the audit committee. And then I think clause 11 is dealing with the maintenance of a financially sound condition. There were some comments about whether the term made provision for is sufficiently clear. It is used elsewhere in the Act, and we do feel it is a term that is used and should be clear to really it's aimed at the statutory actuary. There was another wording comment where we talked about that the insurance, the statutory actuary shouldn't sign off on the payment of dividends by the insurance company if firstly the insurance company is financially unsound. That's already existing. Secondly, if by paying the dividend it would become financially unsound, also an existing provision. And thirdly, we talked about the insurance company shouldn't be paying a dividend if it is deemed to be essentially financially unsound. There were questions about what do we mean by deemed to be, and we've replaced that with wording found elsewhere in the Act, which actually clarifies what we're talking about is if it would result in it being likely to fail within a reasonable period. In other words, we also want to for an insurance company to be conservative about the payment of dividends if it is close to being financially unsound. Then clause 13, again a fairly technical clause dealing with the kind and spreads of assets, and this is where the debate about the use of proper value came in. I think we've covered those issues. Then clause 14 deals with investments in derivatives, also the issue that we covered in the presentation. Then clause 15 is about an independent investigation and the production of a report by a person nominated by the registrar. We've partially, I think, touched on that through the question. There was some comment about whether the particular process that needs to be followed in that regard, whether there need to be specific provisions, but what we're saying is there are already general provisions in the Act dealing with that process. Then clause 16, we're using the term principles and practices of financial management. There's a comment there that should be defined. We're proposing that not be accepted because it's only used in this section. Then clause 17, which amends section 49, this is the binder arrangement. And in fact, this is really a connected section. We had amended this section on limits on remuneration of intermediaries to reflect the earlier version of 49A. But now with the subsequent changes to 49A following further consultation, this amendment is no longer required. Okay, and then clause 18 deals with 49A. And I'm hoping we can come by the time I'm finished the matrix, the colleagues will have come back with the wording. Hopefully they're not retyping the whole thing. Clause 19 This is a clause that deals with a with funeral assistance policies, and this was the issue we highlighted in the briefing around the problems that even though people providing funeral assistance policies are supposed to provide for the option of it to be either a monetary benefit or a non-monetary benefit, in other words, the funeral. That's often hard for consumers to actually enforce because there's currently no provision in the Act which says the monetary benefit must be stated up front in the policy. So we included that, but then the comments were really around wording and tightening things up, and we think the suggestions on wording improvements are good ones, and would like to propose those. Clause 20. Now this deals with which sections of the Act really result in a criminal offence. In the bill that was tabled, there was an amendment that, well, essentially simplified things by saying any contravention can lead to a criminal offence. You know, in subsequent consultation and in the written input, it was recognized, there was a view taken that it may be inappropriate to regard every contravention of whatever nature as contained in the Act or subordinate regulation as a criminal offense. And that's particularly in light of the fact that we now have administrative sanctions. Well, hopefully, administrative sanction powers in terms of the General Financial Services Laws Amendment Bill. So the proposal is to, in a sense, not go forward with the proposed amendment and to revert to the existing wording in the Act, but to include the newly proposed inserted section on 49A dealing with binder agreements, and also to include section 25B dealing with the reporting duty of the statutory actuary. Then we have clause 22, which is again just a wording suggestion which we saying we don't think is necessarily adds much. Then clause 23, this is amended section 72 dealing with regulation by the ministers, and as has been dealt with in the presentation. And then clause 24 amends Schedule 1 of the Principal Act, in particular the definition of futures contract. Again, a small suggestion that we, or the deletion of the word that. Sorry for coming with small things, but I think we think it perhaps improves the wording. There was a comment around putting in enabling provisions around the new dispensation for foreign investment limits. We're not proposing that at this stage. You know, we're still in the process with the Exchange Control Department of the SARB and putting in place the necessary regulatory framework during the course of this year to enable the shift from exchange control to prudential regulation. So, in other words, this is an issue that's still under review, and we're not supporting the comment at this point. Clause 25, Schedule 3, the technical calculations of the values of assets, liabilities, and capital adequacy requirement. Well, there is a wording suggestion, but we don't think it adds to the clarity. And then clause 26. This is this was a comment around using the term binder arrangements instead of binder agreements. We don't agree that it makes a big difference, and binder agreements is consistent with the existing short-term insurance act. Then clause 27, this has been dealt with through the presentation on demarcation. Then there's a definition of the fair value of an asset. This has been dealt with through the proposal changes to the definition of fair value. And then I think definition of this act we've also dealt with. Okay, and then there's the proposal on why be held company. We'll just have to check. I think we did say elsewhere that we weren't. We did agree with the proposal to define widely held company. So this is dealt with through the proposed insertion of the definition. I'm losing track of it. Clause 28, amending section 2 of the Principal Act. Okay, so now we're on to the Short-Term Insurance Act. And I think just to note that actually pretty much 99% of the issues dealt with in the Long-Term Insurance Act that we've gone through are the same amendments and therefore comments in the short term. I wonder if I think in most of the responses we've suggested just referring to the responses in the Long-Term Insurance Act because they're identical. Yeah, so it's really about ensuring consistency between the two acts. Then where there is a difference is on page 37, clause 33. As we discussed in the briefing, we are introducing the new provision of providing that the registrar can appoint or require the appointment of a statutory actuary for a short-term insurer under certain circumstances to enable the implementation of financial condition reporting. And I think, you know, the response is clarifying that an actuary only needs to be appointed under circumstances identified by the registrar, and if the registrar has identified that a short-term insurer must appoint a statutory actuary, then such a short-term insurer must have at all times a statutory actuary. The details of the appointment of a statutory actuary will be dealt with during the approval granted by the registrar. But we are saying the changes are suggested to make sure the section on statutory actuaries in the Short-Term Insurance Act is consistent with the provisions of the Long-Term Insurance Act. And there were some comments on the wording of this provision which were also made to the equivalent section in the Long-Term Insurance Act. Okay, I think the Audit Committee, the comments are the same. Then clause 39. Clause 39. There's some suggestions there, but it's felt that those can rather be included in the amendments to Schedule 2 and to be consistent with the Long-Term Insurance Act. And that the detail, you know, the technical details of risk management requirements are better included in future board notices. So this refers to once there is the introduction of financial condition reporting, those exact requirements would need to be included in board notices, which is where the technical requirements are usually housed. And then there's clause 40. I think we're just making the point there that that the wording was deliberate, as we're specifically only referring to where it relates to capital adequacy requirements of the short-term insurers' liabilities in South Africa. Then clause 41. This is dealing with the valuation. So the same issues covered in the presentation. Clause 45 and 46 refer to the binder agreement. So we'll come back to the binder agreement, but just so then I'm moving on to clause 47 on page 48. In the short term, the difference in the Short Term Insurance Act is that we also have to make reference to Lloyd's representative. That was just a typo that was corrected in the table version. Clause 49. That's the same as under the Long Term Insurance Act, which contraventions are criminal offences. So there's consistency there with the Long Term Insurance Act. And similarly with clause 50, section 64 and 65 refer respectively to cases where it's a contravention by the insurance company, and the other section refers to where it's a contravention by a party other than an insurance company. Then clause 52 has dealt with through the demarcation proposal, and then lastly clause 55. This was just a comment with respect to security required of Lloyd's representative, and those issues would be dealt with in the regulations rather than in the legislation.
Jeff, can I just say,
Jonathan, you want to take us back to that missing section?
Yes, Jen, can I just say, unfortunately the problem seems to be a bigger one. We've had our IT experts working on it. I think they've just overloaded the matrix. So it's not going to be possible to get a printout immediately. Maybe Jonathan just wants to talk through it and we could he'd probably need a bit of time just to reconstruct it, and then we could send it to members later today. This year we will be coming back next week.
Can I have a question on clause 52 before we go?
Okay, why don't we just complete this session and then we'll have full time questions as well.
Thanks, Chair. Luckily, we still have our rough workings with it. Okay, so in terms of the binder agreement, so that deals respectively with 48, 48A of the Short Term Insurance Act and 49A of the Long Term Insurance Act. I think we managed to get from the matrix section 1 dealing with clarifying what is a binder arrangement. And I think the matrix also covered section 2 up to, I think it was the end of G, or in fact we're not proposing any changes to section 2 because section 2 actually deals with what should be contained within the written agreement, and there was I don't think we really had any objections to that in the comments. The most of the comments were around section 3 and 4. Section 3 deals with says I'll read it. It basically says that the written agreement may not and it said it may not authorize that binder party to add an amount to any gross premium or deduct any amount from any claims, and that's basically saying that if there's an agent at the insurance company, it's acting in terms of that written agency agreement, and so therefore can't add any discretionary extra charges or deduct any discretionary fees. Whatever charges the consumer pays or whatever comes off any claim must be specified in the agreement. There were some comments around that. I think specifically some issues around debit order fees. Our view is that can be dealt with through any written agreement. Then 3C was the one clause which caused a lot of comment, because that was a prohibition on profit sharing on the underwriting profits. Now, why that was there, because it was taken from the existing provisions dealing with underwriting managers, and underwriting managers have always worked on that basis. I correct myself. This was there to deal with concerns about some current practices in profit sharing, in particular concerns where group scheme administrators, for instance, or funeral scheme group scheme arrangements would delay sending through claims to the insurance company to try and smooth their profits, for instance. So kind of manipulating issues to manipulate profits. So through the discussions, though, I think we have recognised, and you know, good arguments have been made that it's not all profit-sharing arrangements that are necessarily bad, and that there may be certain kinds of profit-sharing arrangements that create positive incentives for the efficient administration of these insurance policies. So what we're, in a sense, proposing is that we're adding, subject to the requirements and limitations set out in regulations, we are allowing profit sharing. So in other words, through regulations, we would want to set out what we see as undesirable practices in terms of profit sharing, rather than the blanket prohibition. That deals with Section 3. Moving on to Section 4. 4A is a general provision which we are proposing be retained, and I don't think anyone objected to it. It simply says that where there is a written agreement, that binder party can't take on that binder arrangement for any other type of policy other than that type of policy specified in the written agreement. So it's closing those possible loopholes. So you can only do this in terms of a written agreement. Then 4B and C were also caused comment. And it's actually 4B and C. Apologies for the early confusion. It's 4B and C that was taken from the current provision for underwriting managers. And those provisions currently say, you know, what's B and C boiled down to? They're saying that an underwriting manager can't deal directly with the public. They can only underwrite business that's either referred to them by an independent intermediary or referred to them by the insurance company. In other words, that underwriting manager is not taking on the role of either an independent, is not taking on the role of an intermediary. They're only concentrating on the underwriting business. They're not also doing the sales side of things. And that is existing practice for underwriting managers, and the underwriting managers are comfortable, and you know, that's the way they work, and they continue to support that. But where this became tricky, obviously, is that these provisions now apply more broadly, and those brokers, intermediaries with limited binding authority that I mentioned, one of those classes of binder authority, obviously these provisions are a problem for them. Because by their nature they are dealing directly with the public. So what we are proposing is that we take those provisions out of the Act, and where subsequently we're proposing the powers of regulation to identify different kinds or categories of binder agreements. We're also proposing that regulations will also outline when it is acceptable for a binder party to render services in respect of a policy not referred to it by either the insurance company or an intermediary. In other words, when is it acceptable for a party with a binder authority to deal directly with the public? And that would accommodate, we think, accommodate that where the binder authority relates to an independent intermediary and it's limited and it's done in return for commission and there's no profit sharing arrangement, and it is a limited binder authority, then that is consistent with that function also being done by somebody who can deal with the public or is an intermediary. Section 5, Section 5, there were no real comments on, because really it's saying that the insurance company remains, that the underlying insurance company remains responsible for compliance. It remains responsible for liabilities created, and it is the owner of any information and documentation relating to the policies. And then the last section, section 6, had simply stated that any party to a written agreement referred to in subsection 1 must make a copy of the agreement available to the registrar on request, and we didn't receive any objections to that. Chair, lastly, as we've stated, that the proposal is that we deal with certain issues through regulation. What that consequently means is that we would add some additional amendments to Section 70, which deals with regulations. And it would enable regulations prescribing the following criteria contemplated in Section 49A. And then we've listed A to D there, A being allowing to prescribe the different kinds, types, or categories of the binder agreement. B would be limiting or prohibiting any consideration that may be offered or provided for those services in terms of a binder agreement by the insurer. C would be whether or not the person with binder authority can participate in profit sharing that we covered already, and then D, the one we covered already, that the regulations would also prescribe whether that person can effectively deal directly with the public. And to add, you know, what we're proposing is also something that would explicitly state the consultation process around this regulation.
Yeah, you know, when we have those copies and when we deal with it next week, I think it would be important to go over them again. You know, because the binder arrangements or binder agreements, are quite critical to the whole process. But thanks. And also that list of those issues that will have to be in the regulations. Question? Dr. George? Mr. Singh, you had one to ask a question earlier. Any other question? Okay. Dr. George.
Thank you, Chair. I'm just looking for some clarity on this profit sharing thing. My understanding is that maybe on an annual basis you'll have a claims experience on a particular scheme, group scheme, for example. The underwriter will then set the premium on that basis. They'll then have the next year comes along and they say, well, it's been a reasonably good year, there haven't been a lot of claims, therefore we're adjusting the premium based on the claims experience, and maybe there will be a cut, hopefully, or whatever. But if you're looking then at the participation of the agent in the profit sharing, the people or the thing that's generating the benefit are the people that are not claiming. So therefore, I can understand that the underwriter would get a profit out of this because that's their business. But why would the agent be getting profit from something that's been generated by this pool of people? So the benefit should maybe go into the premium rather than to the agent. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. I'm just looking at the Short-Term Insurance Act amendment with the demarcation and things like that. Now, everything is very similar to the earlier clause, except for you've got A, which is a deletion of subsection 1 of paragraph D. Can you just tell us what that subsection is? That's on clause 52. And then on B2, you've got must provide for a long-term insurer to submit specified information on any product, etc., etc., etc. Now, is it because it's only the long-term insurers that offer these kinds of things, or should it be a short-term? Clause 52 of your demarcation document.
Thank you for the question on the binder arrangement. Because I think it's, you know, it well illustrates the issues around these profit sharing arrangements. I think certainly our view is that if it's a sales agent, let's say, who's got a limited binding authority, and there are underwriting profits which arise because, let's say, there's an improvement in economic conditions, and given that binding authority is for a limited time and limited parameters, you know, is there really a rationale for profit sharing there? And I think those are the sensible questions. But where it's what the Underwriting Managers Association referred to as an expert underwriting manager. So it's the real underwriting managers whose sole function is to be specialists in certain kinds of risk, and therefore be and acting as an agent, an extension of the insurer in their underwriting capacity. There, I think we do recognize there's the possibility that profits could come from two sources, two different types of sources. The one is changes in economic conditions. I absolutely agree with the principle. Those benefits should go through to the consumer. But there may also be profits that arise through more efficient administration of those underwriting management arrangements. And where there's improvements in the efficiencies there may be an argument for incentivizing that through profit sharing. And I think that is an area that requires closer analysis. And that's why we're saying we would like to. We're not proposing a blanket prohibition, but certainly we would want the power to be able to say what distinguish between what is perhaps a desirable incentive and what is undesirable profit sharing.
The same question. We were dealing with the same question on
I think the question was regarding the difference between the short term and long term. Can you just refer back to what that?
Yeah, sorry, through you, Chair. On clause 52, the amendment that you proposed in the two-page document. Four pages. Yeah, the deletion there you got, what is being deleted. And then on B2, you say you must provide for a long-term insurer to submit specified information on any product. Is it long-term or should it be short-term?
Sorry, Chair, I think it's a typo. Okay. This two-page only refers to the Long-Term Insurance Act, the changes to the long-term.
I think what they've done,
the first page,
term in the second one.
Yeah,
clearly.
The first one.
Yeah.
Section 123. That one deals with the long-term, and then the other one.
Been working the whole night and pasting, and you know, been like Odessa working right up.
And then I think just the deletion from the definition to see, Joanne, have you got the... Will you just say what's been deleted, Joanne?
Both the long and the short term provision on the medical demarcation issues must mirror perfectly. And I think that's why every time I say something at the top, I paste it in. But we did initially say that the wording has been agreed. But I mean, it is still subject to the state of advisor certification and also for us to read through the final wording, which we will be presenting on the 13th. So I do apologize for that. And I mean, Mama is right. I was cutting and pasting. Philip, if I have to mirror each other perfectly. I'll revert it. If you can just give me 2 seconds, I just want to call up the Short Term Insurance Act to indicate what we are deleting there specifically.
That's fine, but all you're saying is that in order to align the two, we need to allow for some cutting and pasting. it's in the process of aligning. Are you gonna then come back to us? Okay. Now let's break for tea. Let's break for tea and then come back and conclude properly. Joanne, this tea break is just meant to allow you to do that. No, it's okay. When we come back, we'll complete. That's okay. Well, I want us to complete properly.
Regarding the deletion of subsection 1 under clause 52, that relates not to the definition of accidental health or health policy, but it relates to another amendment that we're making to enable us to in future introduce the financial condition reporting or the risk-based capital. So the deletion of subsection 1 refers to the additional amount or additional asset requirement that short-term insurance companies must hold, so we're deleting that reference, and we're putting all the requirements relating to the creation or provision of liabilities and additional capital requirements in a separate board notice. So, and I think in the document that Jonathan had with regards to the demarcation, he just kept the whole amendment as it is currently in the amendment pulled together. So subsection 1 has nothing to do with.
Okay. Another question? It's Friday. Look, that actually then brings us to the end of the session. Of course, leaves us with more work for next week, because we have the undertaking from National Treasury and FSB of further consultation, particularly the Tuesday. Maybe the conference, or but I know it's because it involves all you know the concerned stakeholders, and when we return, we would then be looking at how well we've done with that, and we agree with you that it's not possible to get 100% consensus, but we would want to be satisfied that people have actually been given an opportunity and that their concerns have been dealt with adequately, but whether to the total satisfaction of everyone, I don't think we've ever been able to achieve that. But,
Chair, just on that, I know we have time frames and timetables, parliamentary and everything else, but just to ask the question, if they meet on Tuesday, is it sufficient time, you know? I don't know when this is scheduled for us. Is it the day after, the 13th? Or the Friday? I just want to know, is it sufficient time for us to get, you know, we don't want to hear again that there hasn't been enough consultation, things like that.
That's actually in addition to what has already, you know, taken place between last Friday and today, because if you look at the process, there quite has been extensive consultation, and we would want to see Tuesday as actually the culmination of, you know. We are informed that some of the areas of agreement have actually been identified where we, you know, if you look at the amendments, they actually arrive entirely out of that.
Yeah,
Chairperson, just on that point as well, I mean, is there any way that, I mean, some of the industry players are here, can we ask them, would that be sufficient in terms of, because I got the impression that you know, it will be pushing it very, very hard in terms of after Tuesday's meeting to go back to their constituents, sign it off and you be, you know, be able to submit it on Friday.
I do not want them to change the makeup of this of today's meeting, because we haven't invited all the stakeholders. If those that are here are the only ones that have an opportunity of saying at adequate time, then I must tell you, I mean, if I were to be asked that question, I will always say it's not adequate. So let's allow the process to unfold, and if as Parliament, when we meet on Friday next week, Parliament feels that that's not adequate, it's up to this committee to say no, 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 that we're still unhappy. But again, we have our own processes as Parliament. You know, we can't be always imposing on national tourism. Parliament wants to open it for another round of hearings. That's what this committee should decide to do. So say we want to open it for hearings, because I don't think the consultation process we're talking about is national tourism and the FSB. But we also have our constitutional responsibility of opening a forum for this consultation. So we should not. I don't think we should confuse the two. But I don't want the ones that are here to have an unfair advantage over the others that are not here, that they were given an opportunity to say, no, it's not enough. They can say it's not enough until next year. But let's allow the process that National Treasury and the FSB are on, and we are saying to them they should come back with something that is concrete that says this is what has happened. As we do have something already in writing, and I had Joanne saying also that there is something in writing from the Council for Medical Schemes, there is something in writing from the Department of Health, and when we say the industry, you know, this industry, we're talking a very broad industry here, and I don't want some people to enjoy an advantage which otherwise the others don't. Mr. Momoyet, do you want to say something?
Yes, Chair, I just wanted to add, so what we will be doing is this afternoon emailing all the documents that you've been given just to all the people who have sent submissions, put it on our website, and so all those at least who have submitted comments will know this afternoon there's a meeting on Tuesday if they haven't heard already, and anyone else wants to come, and so they will have the documents to comment on once Jonathan's collected his clickers and errors and so on. Just to assure you, and we will come back if there are any material issues that arise. We will alert you. Assure you of that.
Comment? Lunch will be served at 12 o'clock. The meeting is adjourned. Thank you.